Daniel chapter 1, then. Let's hear God's word together. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, to Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them and found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. It wasn't so long ago, of course, that just about everybody in this country was a Christian. It wasn't so long ago that you couldn't get into the University of Cambridge unless you were a confirmed member of the Church of England. Of course, other religions did exist, but they were so remote geographically, we could afford to disdain them as pagan superstitions. Of course, there were skeptical philosophers too, some of whom dared openly to call themselves atheists. But they were generally regarded as rather bizarre, scandalous individuals. In the 19th and 18th centuries in Britain, toleration really only served to operate with different branches of the Christian church, if there. No one seriously suggested that people of other faith, or even of no faith at all, should be treated with the same respect as Christians. The very idea was unthinkable. Christendom in those days, you see, was synonymous with civilization. If you didn't subscribe to the former, you had dubious claim to the latter. But that, I stress, is how things used to be. It's not like that anymore, is it? You don't have to be an acute social observer to realize that these days there has been an extraordinary decline in that Christian identity in culture in this country. Partly under the pressure, I suppose, of international trade and technological advance and communication advance and so forth, the world has shrunk. It's become a global village. We can no longer treat other major religions with indifference. They are on our doorstep. Indeed, in post-colonial immigration Britain, they've come over the doorstep. They are within our country, mosques and Hindu temples and so forth, in every major city. Nor can irreligion any longer be dismissed as an eccentricity. Large numbers of people espouse atheism or agnosticism, Nobody any longer feels any embarrassment with saying, I'm not a Christian. Any RE teacher will quickly confirm that in an average class of school children today, there will be very few who would want to be known as Christians by their peers or even know what they meant by the word. A new kind of society is emerging then, has emerged, one in which Christianity no longer occupies a privileged position. And though there are still plenty of church spires on the skyline, they are dwarfed now by the skyscrapers of commerce. And though there are still bishops sitting in the House of Lords, their influence is zero. And though the monarch is still crowned in Westminster Abbey, it may not be that way much longer. For religious pluralism has been effectively accepted as the new social reality in our world. Christianity, which was once the ideological spearhead of progress and empire, has now been marginalized and neutralized. Some, of course, would like us to believe that this new pluralism will be marked by a greater degree of religious tolerance, and I suppose in some respects it will. But I fear, as far as the experience of Christians are concerned, that is likely to be an illusion. Because, of course, the only faiths which the new pluralism will tolerate are faiths that are compatible with its pluralistic concept. Any religion that adheres to those old ideas of absolute truth, divine revelation, exclusive salvation, any religion that talks in those kinds of terms is going to find life in the 21st century tough going. That would include the Jew and the Muslim and the Christian. In fact, already we're beginning to see evidence that Christians are finding it hard to progress in their secular careers if they are serious about their faith. There are certain kinds of jobs where an atmosphere of suspicion and even discrimination is beginning to appear against Christians in this so-called Christian country. But of course, the result of pluralism is not a neutral world in which every person is able to pursue their self-chosen religion or philosophy. What pluralism always produces, as in ancient Rome, is a pagan world in which occultism and superstition of a thousand kinds may be freely tolerated and given free rein, but in which religions of revelation, the great world religions of divine revelation, will find themselves discriminated against. That's why the book of Daniel is interesting and relevant. That's why I think it's worth looking at it, even this morning, as many of you embark on a new academic year here in Cambridge. For you see, Daniel was a young man too, who was thrown from a world of religious privilege suddenly into a world of religious pluralism, a pagan world. You'll notice from the very first verses of the book that his story takes place during the exile, when the cream of Jewish society was, as it were, skimmed out of Jerusalem and deported to the vast metropolis of Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. It was a beautiful city. It was in process of reconstruction at the time, but it would soon become one of the ancient wonders of the world, a city more impressive in its architecture and technology than anything the Jews had ever seen before, a magnificence that made even Jerusalem, which they thought wonderful, seem insignificant, dull and primitive by comparison. Supremely, though, of course, Babylon was also a victorious city, the capital of a huge empire which had completely humiliated the armed forces of the entire Middle East, including those pathetic armies of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. This, of course, had been a devastating blow to Judah's national pride. Not just her pride, her religious faith, too. For she believed that her God, Jehovah, was supreme above all gods. It surely followed then that his chosen sanctuary and his chosen people were inviolable. And yet here was a pagan who had defiled the one, the temple, and taken capture the other, the people. If you put yourself for a moment in the position of these Jews, you'll see, I think, that their experience in many ways has parallels to that of Christians in the Western Church in the last 50 or 60 years or so. Like us, the Jews could remember days when biblical religion dominated their social horizons. When paganism existed but was so remote from their circle of interest, they could ignore it or even despise it as some inferior superstition. They could remember times when they lived in a theocracy where church and state were so entangled it was impossible to separate religion from politics. To be anything or anybody in society, you had to be a faithful Jew in those days. It was unthinkable to be anything else. But now suddenly it's all changed. The world has shrunk somehow. Those pagan rivals to biblical religion were not only on the doorstep, they have crossed the threshold. The Jews now find themselves as immigrants themselves, stripped of all their former privileges and powers, in a vast secular empire. For the first time in their experience, it was no longer an advantage to be a practicing Jew. On the contrary, opportunity and social advancement were much more likely to come to those who showed themselves willing to accommodate to the culture and lifestyle of their pagan masters. This, you see, is the great challenge for the Jew in exile. Not unlike the challenge for a Christian living in the late 20th century. How do you sustain and practice a biblical faith in a pluralist society in which you are no more than a rather unfashionable, odd religious minority? Now that's the question Daniel helps us to think through. In the later chapters, of course, Daniel is presented to us as a great hero. A man who, you may recall, was willing to go to a den of lions overnight because he wouldn't give up his daily prayer time. But in chapter 1 of the book of Daniel, we're given a little insight as to where that heroic man of faith, whom Daniel later became, where he came from, how he developed, where he learned that ability to stand up in a pagan world and be counted for his God. And according to the book of Daniel, the first evidence of that, which was going to make Daniel such a great man, was seen in his university days. The king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. Now, it's quite clear that this generous educational program, which Nebuchadnezzar provided for these selected members of the Jewish aristocracy, was politically motivated. It was a maneuver designed to turn potential rebels into compliant vassals. It was an attempt to assimilate them into Babylonian culture. An intensive degree course in Chaldean liberal arts at the new University of Babylon would surely be enough to sever the Jewish roots of these impressionable youngsters in a quite irreversible way, he reasoned. Why, if they turn out good, we might even be able to make use of them in the diplomatic corps, turning these gauche and recalcitrant country bumpkins from Jerusalem into real Babylonians. Why, by the time we've finished with them, they won't even remember their Hebrew names. That's why they gave them new ones, of course. It was an ingenious scheme. If Ashpenaz was right about the results of their IQ tests, Daniel and his friends would not be able to resist the intellectual challenge and stimulation on offer. So much, you see, that was new on the curriculum. New languages to learn. New books to read. For the first time, science and astronomy and mathematics. Subjects they'd never heard of before, some which they weren't even allowed to study, for religious reasons perhaps. A whole feast of learning made all the more palatable by the quality of the college meals. For every day these favoured young men would dine at high table on fare drawn directly from the king's own kitchens. And unexpectedly, that was the issue, we're told, over which Daniel put his foot down. Notice that in verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Now, the obvious question to ask is why? Why did Daniel take this obstreperous line? After all, we don't read he made any complaint about his new Babylonian name. He certainly didn't boycott lectures at the new Babylonian university. On the contrary, according to verse 19, at his oral examination before the emperor, he and his friends graduated at the top of the class. They kind of starred first for the whole lot of them. So there's no evidence of any anti-Babylonian demos on the campus. No blank examination papers handed in at the end of term. If Daniel was willing to cooperate with so much of this cultural assimilation program to which he and his friends were being subjected, why does he object to the food? Some speculate it has to be because of some ritual taboo. And Jewish law did lay down, as you probably know, certain dietary restrictions. So did Daniel refuse to eat because the food wasn't kosher, as he would say? Well, I don't think it can have been that, because we read he objected to the wine just as much as to the food. And there was no ceremonial prohibition against alcohol in the law of Moses, as some of you may be pleased to hear. And yet clearly Daniel's reluctance to eat the emperor's food was religious in nature, in origin, because we're told in verse 8, he resolved not to defile himself. Now that word, I think, quite definitely implies he saw the issue as one of moral or spiritual pollution. It wasn't just that he was a vegetarian, though he clearly had nothing against eating a diet of just vegetables, as we later see. He wasn't on principle a vegetarian, nor was he having trouble adjusting in his stomach to a foreign diet. It wasn't anything like that. That word defile indicates this was an issue of religious conscience for him. To eat the king's food would have been for Daniel to compromise his personal holiness in some way. But why? Some have suggested that Daniel's scruples on this matter were due to the fact that the emperor's food would have been consecrated to idols before it was served, which may well have been true. But the text makes no mention of that. And frankly, it's unlikely that the vegetables, which Daniel ate instead, were any less contaminated by pagan rituals. Now, I think the only conclusion we can safely draw is that Daniel judged that sharing the king's table was one step further than he was prepared to go in accommodating himself to this new situation in a pagan world. As a believer in an unbelieving world, he clearly felt he had to draw a line somewhere. And this was where he decided he was going to draw it. In the ancient world, you see, eating with somebody was a sign of friendship. It was a sign of alliance. In diplomatic context, it was often a sign of political allegiance. Some kind of covenant or contract or treaty between political leaders would be sealed by eating a meal together. But Daniel was a member of a nation which was bound by exclusive covenant to Jehovah, the Lord God. No other loyalty could ever be permitted to usurp the priority of that relationship in Daniel's life. He was clear about that. And Daniel seems to have felt that eating food from the king's table, even if the king wasn't personally present, threatened that loyalty to an unacceptable degree. It created too intimate a relationship between him and his pagan master. Now, maybe some of us are asking ourselves whether Daniel wasn't being a little bit excessive in that, whether he wasn't being a little over-scrupulous, unnecessarily sensitive. I mean, would eating from the king's table really have done any harm to him or his friends? After all, didn't Jesus himself say, it isn't the food we eat that makes us unclean, it's the sins that arise from our hearts that really defile us. Which, of course, is true. Surely you might say it was up to Daniel whether he allowed himself to be bribed by this Babylonian banquet or not. Wasn't it possible for him to enjoy the good food and still retain an uncompromising devotion to God? theory, perhaps it was possible. But it seems, at least in Daniel's judgment, in this particular situation, to have been too much of a risk in practice. At least for him. He felt, as I say, he needed to draw a line somewhere, to dig his toes in somewhere. Or else there was a real danger that he was going to be swept into a wholesale abandonment of his Jewish cultural roots. You notice there it says in verse 8, he resolved not to defile himself. I think literally the word, the phrase is purposed in his heart. And I think it conveys the thought of an inner wrestling with his conscience, which results in a personal determination to make a principled stand on the matter. He resolved. If we ask why he was so clear he needed to resolve that, there may have been three factors, I think, which influenced him. He may have felt that this gesture of dissociation from the emperor was necessary as an act of testimony to the Babylonians, to his tutors, to his guards. He may have felt it was, as we would say in Christian vocabulary, an act of witness. As if he wanted to communicate something like this. I may be acquiescing in your educational program, but don't run away with the idea that I'm abandoning my faith. No, the emperor can't bribe me into becoming one of his stooges. I may have no choice but to be his servant. But in spiritual terms, I can never volunteer to become his ally. Something like that. Or secondly, Daniel may have felt it was necessary to dissociate himself from the emperor in this way to boost the morale of his fellow students. An act, as we might say, of leadership. It does seem that Daniel was recognized as some kind of leader amongst his fellow students. In that case, he may have been wanting to communicate something along these lines. We may be Nebuchadnezzar's guinea pigs in this educational crash course of his, but we don't have to be his puppy dogs, begging titbits from our master's table. Let's show them that we retain our Jewish dignity and independence. Let's have a little student protest movement on a minor scale. But I suspect primarily Daniel felt it necessary to perform this gesture of dissociation from the emperor as an affirmation of his own personal spiritual commitment to prevent the corruption of his own heart. Perhaps technically there was nothing sinful about eating the king's food. But for Daniel, you see, in this delicate situation, as a believer, needing to sustain and practice biblical faith in this new pagan environment, it was one step too far, one concession too many. He knew himself well enough, I guess, to realize he wasn't immune to the enticements of Babylonian culture. The fascination of occultism and magic in which Babylonian learning excelled. The political opportunity there would be for him once his Babylonian training was complete. The seduction of influential and beautiful pagan women, of which no doubt the Babylonian court possessed many. Daniel was surrounded daily by dozens of temptations to apostasy, temptations to which he knew he was not impervious. If he was going to remain true to God in the face of this assault upon his spirituality, it would require self-discipline. He couldn't afford to allow himself to be softened up in any way. There may have been nothing morally wrong with enjoying the Babylonian luxury he was being offered. But it represented such a softening device, a threat to his personal discipline and commitment, and he could not risk it. I mean, we all know, don't we? We all know why businessmen offer lunches to their clients. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And I have to say, speaking personally now as a pastor, I can see great wisdom in Daniel's line. His caution in this matter was not misplaced. For the king's food is seductive. And those who eat too much of it do fall into compromise. I could cite you many examples I have seen over the years. A medical student I remember very well from my own student days was an outstandingly fine Christian serving on the Christian Union executive, but who over the years since they left university has become more and more secularized, less and less clear in their Christian testimony. It's as if the king's food has got to them somehow. I can think of an engineer from a few years ago, from Singapore, actually. Another brilliant student, qualified with a first, I think at the top of the class. As far as I know, he is nowhere now spiritually, though he's very senior, I think, in a Shell petroleum company. Beware of the king's food. By such inoffensive and gentle techniques do we get sucked into what the Bible might call worldliness. The New Testament tells us of one disciple called Demas, who left Paul and apparently left the Christian community altogether because he had fallen in love, says Paul, with the present age. Daniel's scruples may have been over a small matter. You see, if we don't learn to draw the line somewhere, to make a stand over something, then when the moment comes when it really does require a considerable exercise of moral courage to stand as a Christian, we may lack the backbone to do so. One recalls the savage ruthlessness of Jesus' advice on just such issues. If your eye causes you to sin, he says, pluck it out. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Better, he says, to enter life maimed than having two eyes or two hands to go to hell. Maybe that text is a commentary on Daniel's example of self-denial here. There are some things, you see, which, though they may be perfectly innocent in themselves, so undermine or threaten to undermine our Christian commitment, so weaken our moral fibre, so sap our spiritual resolve, that if we are wise, we will deny ourselves the experience of them. Certain books we are better not to read, perhaps, because though they may not corrupt everybody, they will corrupt us. Certain places perhaps we're better not to go. Because though at our strongest we would not be led into sin in that particular situation, in a moment of vulnerability, it represents a moral hazard to us. Certain luxuries perhaps we're better not to enjoy. Because although there's nothing sinful in good food or good wine or fast cars or expensive hobbies, etc., etc., such things can defile us, as the king's food, Daniel felt, might defile him. Sometimes we need to adopt, perhaps, dare I say, a simpler lifestyle than our neighbours. Not out of any kind of ascetic fanaticism, not out of any kind of spurious guilt trip about third world poverty, not even out of some kind of idealistic green protest about the evils of capitalist consumerism, but rather because, we need to be witnesses in a pagan world. And B, because our Christian friends and colleagues sometimes need to draw strength from our example. And C, because none of us is immune to compromise. You have to draw a line somewhere. Clearly, Daniel didn't feel he needed to opt out of Babylonian society altogether. That's important to note, isn't it? He didn't feel he had to refuse the educational opportunity that experience was giving to him. Perhaps he already knew from a letter that Jeremiah had written to the exiles in Babylon that God's instruction to his faithful believing people in that place was to settle down and to seek the peace and the prosperity of the city where he had placed them. Maybe he knew that. It was very important advice, amply illustrated by David's willingness to get involved in that secular world, to be a witness there, a courageous witness there for biblical faith, to accept employment, to pursue education in a secular university. He wasn't compromising his faith by doing so. But if you're going, you see, to immerse yourself in that way, in a pluralistic, secular world, you have to find some way to retain your distinctive as a loyal subject of your true sovereign. So beware. Those of you who are new students here, beware of the king's food. Beware it doesn't anesthetize your spiritual zeal. Beware it doesn't take the edge off your discipleship. Daniel, you see, could only be that courageous old man in the lion's den, because once he had been a slightly awkward young man in the king's university. He could only say no then, because he'd learned to say no much earlier in his life. And if we don't learn to put our feet down, perhaps even over what seem to be very small issues, the same may be true of us one day. Our feet will slip over the really big issues. Let's pray together, shall we?